This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Broadband Wireless Access World. We're about to talk to Patrick Leary, who's the assistant vice president for marketing at Alvarion. And if, as though that weren't enough, he's also the chief evangelist. Welcome to Broadband Wireless Access World. Patrick?
Good morning or good afternoon. I'm not sure.
Right.
It's live.
Yes, it's afternoon here in L.A. Where are you?
I am actually in San Diego this afternoon here as well.
So it's the same time in both places. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about Alvarion, starting with where the name comes from, and then just a little bit of background about the company and what it's involved with.
Well, Alvarion is actually the initial company founded in 1992 was Freescom. Freescom Wireless was one of the original wireless LAN pioneers, contributing some early technology to the very first 802.11. So we started, our genesis really began as a wireless LAN company. Then beginning about 1998, we began to migrate from that into the access space. We acquired another company through merger by the name of Flowware, which primarily made license band products, and we changed our name to Alvarion. Why Alvarion? Maybe because it was an open URL. Not sure, but seriously, it can be pronounced in multiple languages and has some kind of interesting esoteric meanings that we could define as we went along, I suppose.
Okay, and that's what you're doing, I guess, is defining it as you go along. It doesn't specifically relate to any particular niche or technology.
Not specifically, other than that we are a wireless broadband company. The key there being that we are a broadband company, the modifier being wireless, and I think that's important to recognize because the subject matter here that is important that anyone cares about is the broadband.
Okay, let's talk about it, sort of define that space. It's point-to-multipoint broadband wireless access, or BWA. What exactly is that space?
What exactly is that space is, if you look at high-speed wireless from an IP sense, Internet Protocol, which is what we're talking about here essentially, there's really two types. And most people are familiar with the first type being Wi-Fi or wireless LAN. Although there are some shared similarities in their early days, the access space has kind of broken off in the late 90s, and you began to see products that were being built specifically for outdoor use to create in a somewhat of a cellular architecture outdoor connectivity for the last mile or the first mile, depending on your point of emphasis,
right,
to connect residences and businesses over long range. Long range being anywhere from maybe a 5-mile radius cell to perhaps even a 10-mile radius cell, depending on the terrain. And the speeds initially are consistent with DSL cable, but there are products existing today that can get you to an individual subscriber in excess of 20 megabits true net throughput. Multipoint.
Okay, now I have a few questions about the technology. How would you say, maybe we could compare it with cellular. How does BWA compare as a technology with cellular? What's similar about them? What's different?
Well, what's similar is that they are cellular in architecture in terms of, you know, you're going up in a tower a couple hundred feet or so. You have these sectors that are shooting a swath of, you know, radio frequency, you know, a certain distance, and then users are connecting that back to the tower. In the case of wireless broadband today, it's primarily fixed, migrating its way ultimately towards a mobile or portable environment. But again, the users today are primarily fixed. What's different is that it's basically a data-first sort of application of technology. It's IP-centric, although there are wireless local loop, true TDM voice versions of similar technologies that kind of come into play, where cellular is basically voice first, and then, oh, by the way, coming along on top of it, here's a little bit of data that you can do as well. BWA, or wireless broadband, as I prefer to say it, is first, last, and first about data, and then voice, and then maybe even ultimately video builds on from the data side of it.
Okay. Now, obviously, there's more power at the transmitter than there is at any one of the particular nodes that users are using. How does, and obviously, internet is a two-way street. How do signals get back from the users upstream to the transponder of the BWA system?
Actually, Mark, that's only partially correct. There are many systems today. You have to remember it's a very broad space, whereas in cellular you're dealing with just a couple frequency bands, really, even globally. In wireless broadband, you have products built specifically for these types of applications that range anywhere from, say, the unlicensed bands of 900 megahertz, 2.4, and the various 5 gigahertz bands. Then you have licensed bands, such as the most popular one globally is 3.5 gigahertz or 3,500 megahertz, depending on how you prefer to refer to it.
Right.
And the power of each of these different bands vary not only within, well, they vary by region, by regulation, even by license versus unlicensed. In most cases, unlicensed frequencies tend to be lower power. However, the client-side devices, if they're in a fixed environment, have the same sort of power generally that you see at the base station. So you're able to create a fairly symmetric power arrangement back and forth. The lesser power of an end user occurs when you begin to add mobility or portability, in that you're talking about an end user device that might ultimately be embedded, for example, in a laptop, like ultimately of the WiMAX chip that Intel is developing will ultimately be embedded into laptops. And of course there, the power ratio is far less on the user side, so that just means you have cells that are more contracted versus their fixed counterparts.
Okay, so what you're saying is that now, what does the apparatus at a client site look like for typically for BWA?
Extraordinarily varied, but in general, today, something about the size of a paperback book is probably about accurate. In terms of the antenna today, they generally are externally mounted antennas, although in some licensed varieties, you have the power abilities to do an indoor-only subscriber, even though even that often will have, say, for example, a window patch antenna that, again, might be about the size of a paperback. But a very common antenna in the U.S. today, which is primarily has unlicensed deployments, again, U.S., the rest of the world is somewhat different. You're dealing with an external antenna that's, a small pizza box, maybe a foot square, roughly.
Okay, so people have to have one of those, and it has to not move, and that generates sufficient power to communicate with the central dispatch office of BWA.
Right, and you can get pretty considerable ranges. Even old generation technology, while you could get very good ranges, maybe 20 or more miles, the problem they suffered in the earlier generations were the technology was strictly line of sight, otherwise known as LOS.
Right.
In which case, you had models out there that were doing 35-mile cells, but what you really had were 35-mile shadows, because anything that was in the way created a shadow behind that thing, whatever that was, a tree or a building. Today's technologies are far advanced from that. With the developments on the processing side and on the RF technologies, you're able now to achieve pretty significant distance, even in a non-line of sight, and certainly a near-line of sight arrangement, meaning even through trees to some degree, around buildings, and for example, an urban landscape like, for example, there in L.A., there are common everyday technologies today made for wireless broadband that could enable you to get, for example, to do a 2.5-mile cell, perhaps, in, say, downtown L.A., in a strictly non-line-of-sight environment and still get a very stable, reliable, high-speed connection, maybe in excess of, 6 or more megabits.
So you could essentially put this on one of the high towers in downtown Los Angeles and cover a pretty wide area directly into all those buildings?
Up on a building somewhere, similar to where you would find the infrastructure for the voice side of cellular.
Similar
towers.
Okay. Can you distinguish between the relationship between what Alvarion does and its technology and WiMAX, and tell us what WiMAX is and how it relates to what Alvarion does, whether it's the same or it's a subset or a superset, and what the relationship there is?
Sure. Alvarion's been at this game for a long time. In fact, today we just reported earnings and had a nice record quarter in Q2 with, I think it was $48.8 million and kind of the only profitable company in the space.
Right.
In any event, we've been doing this for a long time, but all the products to date necessarily have been proprietary because there has not been any standard specifically created for the delivery of broadband wirelessly.
Right.
Okay, you have 802.11 standards, okay, but that's wireless LAN, primarily for shorter distance, although, you know, we see some longer links. In fact, we hold the Guinness for a 310-kilometer link in Wi-Fi.
Right.
Still, different technology. The technologies that are being used in a proprietary sense, all the different vendors have made them their own versions that accomplish or overcome a lot of the limitations, for example, that Wi-Fi has. So what WiMAX seeks to do is it's based on the IEEE's first efforts at creating a standard specifically and solely intended for wireless broadband. And that standard, as ratified today, is called 802.16-2004. Okay, that sounds complicated because we know 802.11, A, B, G, et cetera, et cetera. And you might have heard 802.16, A and D. What the IEEE decided to do, instead of continuing with this alphabet soup of naming, when they've ratified anything on the 802.16 side, once it's firmly ratified, they give it a year assignment that it was ratified so that we can all follow this thing chronologically.
Okay, so and the version we're talking about in particular now is called 802.16-2004.
That is correct.
Okay.
And that is the initial standard on which WiMAX products will be based.
Okay.
But even that standard is a relatively broad standard and actually includes a number of different physical ways of delivering a signal. And so what the WiMAX form was created by Alvarian and a couple other companies to take that standard and basically winnow down all the various things that you can do there
right. Into
a very simple, definable set of technical profiles that, as vendors, we can all build interoperable products.
Right. I think I went through this with MPEG-4 in the past, that the standards body puts up a general standard that specifies sort of the outer limits of the standard, and then the companies get together and decide on the more particular formulations that they're going to want to use.
Right. There's no way that the market can create really attractive business models at the residential for the residential side until we can get a standard in which can achieve some degree of volume, which of course achieves mass and interoperability, and all those things help drive down pricing.
Right. To beat the horse a little bit here, the point is that interoperability is important so that companies that make the transmitters and make the user equipment and so on are all literally on the same page so that the machines talk to each other, essentially.
Absolutely. And
okay.
It's important that the market be driven towards some degree of commoditization on the client side, so we have end-user devices that can compete with cable modems and DSL modems, and in fact, even go less than that as we begin to see subscriber devices embedded into laptops, maybe 2008, something like that, where you have the zero CPE-less model. But none of that can happen without a defined standard, and then an industry organization created to basically help commercialize that.
Okay, and that's what you were mentioning in terms of the Intel chip, that the WiMAX chip that would be installed in laptops that would give people essentially mobility with the WiMAX standard and connectivity to their Intel-based laptop.
Yes, and that's moving forward some years. Initially, it begins with fixed WiMAX subscribers and then ultimately migrating to accept mobility as well. And the two will live inside the same cell.
Right. So you'll be stationary in your house, or you get in your SUV and you've got the screens in the back seat for the kids who can watch videos being sent over WiMAX.
Perhaps.
Maybe.
I mean, at the simplest need is if you're like me and you do a lot of traveling, you flip open your laptop and you get a Wi-Fi connection in the airport.
Right.
But then the next gate you're sitting at, okay, you got to establish a new connection and you got to go through the whole authentication process and yada, yada, yada. It's a bit cumbersome. And what one of the things WiMAX will enable is for, you know, national arrangements similar to the cellular, well, virtually identical to cellular, where, you know, once you're on in one place, close your laptop, pop it on, open in Dubuque, Iowa,
right,
and you're still on.
Right. So it's always on wherever you are, and it's wireless.
Right.
What specifically is the difference, if any, between the proprietary standards that Alvarian is using now and WiMAX, the 802.16-2004?
Well, the products today that we have proprietary are very competent, as evidenced by the number of operators we have using them. However, they are still proprietary. So the primary thing that's different is that, okay, the WiMAX version, and of which our product is called BreezeMAX, which was announced in June of this year, is, you know, built up from the ground up to support this standard. So it can achieve, technically, we can achieve these similar things with our current proprietary product, but we can't achieve mass until we're able to deliver a standard product that's, you know, WiMAX endorsed.
So you're saying that BreezeMAX is WiMAX compatible?
No such thing as compatible yet, because there are, the WiMAX form has not yet begun to certify products. That's expected to begin perhaps as early as late this year.
When it starts certifying it, will BreezeMAX be able to be certified?
It was built from the ground up as to be WiMAX ready, I guess. Would be
WiMAX ready, okay.
So that this is our platform that we will submit for certification.
Okay.
It's not a product that we've taken and done a little tweaking to, and then we'll put it for certification. It's something we've been working on for better part of 4 years to develop specifically for this event.
It's your flagship WiMAX ready product.
That is correct.
And it's in place now. It's being used now. It's just not calling itself WiMAX. It's calling itself BreezeMAX.
Well, it's being used in several trials that we've got around the world that I think have been discussed. The operators have not yet been named.
Right.
But the proprietary product is installed. I don't know, there's like close to 2 million units installed.
Right.
But even in our own portfolio of products, if you look at them, there's three main types. There's a wireless local loop product, which is used in many of these greenfield markets, developing regions, where, okay, we want data, fast data. Many parts of the world, they need voice.
Right.
So that product delivers true TDM voice and some IP data. Then there's a product that does what we call multi-services, ATM, you know, frame E1s, T1s, and multi-point, that sort of thing. Then there's this other product called Breeze Access, which is strictly IP for data. So even a company like Alvarion, we have three distinct products for essentially three different applications.
Right.
And what WiMAX is enabling is for all these things to basically, all these different applications to collapse into the BreezeMAX product line over time.
I've got it. And will voice over IP be a way of delivering voice over the data channels?
Certainly WiMAX is designed, and the 802.16-2004 standard is designed specifically to do that.
So you'll be essentially able to integrate voice and data?
From the start.
Right. And what about video? Is that ready to go? It needs more bandwidth, or it's going to be able to do that?
It has the hooks for the prioritization of those sorts of applications. The trick will be is that, you know, there's lots of different spectrum we're talking about here, and certain bands will have wider channels, which means more bandwidth that you can squeeze through them than others.
Right.
For example, the license bands, it's very common that you're dealing with multiple channels that are only 6 megahertz wide, which is basically a very small amount of space. And so there's only so much data that you can, you know, cram into there.
Right.
And will you be able to do video? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe it's a little bit too soon to tell. But other bands, say, for example, 5 gigahertz, where the WiMAX profile would probably define something maybe 10 megabits wide. Okay, you can achieve speeds that can certainly do video. For example, the efficiency of WiMAX systems today, like BreezeMAX, is roughly 4 bits per hertz per second, which is about 4 megabit per megahertz per second.
Okay.
Compare that to Wi-Fi, which is 0.5 bits per hertz per second.
Eight times smaller. Right.
In terms of the efficiency of the spectrum.
Okay.
So, yes, these are high-capacity systems. You can pump a lot of data through it, and, you know, will it migrate towards video someday? It's too early to tell, but it's certainly designed with that intent.
Will doing that require what technical breakthroughs or spectrum licensing arrangements would be necessary, or more compression? Where is more easier video transmission going to take place?
Mark, I'm not any kind of expert on video, so I couldn't even pretend to,
okay,
to intelligently answer.
But essentially it's set up to do it. It could do it in sort of small doses now. It's not going to be a way people fill their TV screens yet, but it can be. They could certainly fill a laptop with it.
You know, the capacity's there, and who knows, maybe certain content providers will, you know, have their own niche applications,
right,
you know, streaming news or,
right,
you know, whether they're actually doing TV channels, I don't know. It's way too early to tell that.
Okay, I think we've got enough background now. Let's talk about the test in Georgia. Who organized it, what it involved, and, well, why you picked that particular place in Georgia to do it. But focus on Alvarion's part in the planning and implementation of that test.
Okay, well, first I'll say we didn't pick it. It kind of picked us.
Right.
And it being Houston County. Houston County is kind of in central Georgia. It's a progressive county despite its rural roots. It has one of the fastest growing areas in Georgia. A lot of technology. It's an area of one of the largest military industrial complexes in the state. I think it is the largest military industrial complex within the state.
There's a big Air Force base there.
There's, yeah, Warner Robins. So there's, technically they're fairly progressive. They actually have quite a bit of high speed access now.
Right.
But it's not ubiquitous. It is a bit spotty.
Right.
But within Houston County, there's a gentleman called Matt Stone who is somewhat kind of the broadband champion in that environment. And all these communities, anyone that's doing this needs to have a champion that kind of pushes it along.
Right.
But he basically began the process, and he brought in Intel into the equation, and it's through Intel's, I think it was partly their Digital Cities Initiative, but Intel is a major partner with Houston County in a technology project within the school system there.
Right. When did they institute that program? Do you know about?
Matt Stone can tell you more about that. I'm not sure of the exact date.
It's been in the last year or so, all of this, though, has it?
Yeah, it's been in the works for a while. The technology program with Intel in the school system goes back maybe a couple years.
Okay, and what did Intel do in the schools there exactly?
I'm not exactly sure.
Okay, we'll find out. I'll find out from Matt. Right.
But it blossomed from there in the conversations in terms of, okay, taking these abilities, what they're doing in the schools and being able to, let's take this out in the community, be able to connect everyone, and this big vision of ubiquitous connectivity and enabling economic development, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
The same arguments we all hear.
Right.
So Intel ultimately brought in Siemens, and Siemens brought in Alvarion. So what's interesting is this is the first project in the state that has what you might call the three leaders of the WiMAX value chain.
Right. And what does Siemens contribute to that chain?
In this case, it's Siemens Business Consulting.
Right.
And they bring in the consultative piece. They're kind of, let's call them the shepherd herders, I guess.
Right.
And they're bringing in all the diverse people. All we are is just the equipment manufacturer.
So they kind of
supplied product, supplied expertise, engineers, test recommendations, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right, so Siemens sort of brings in the administrative, non-technical stuff, apparently.
Yeah, they pull it all together.
Okay, they manage the project.
And manage the project, massage the business case, bring in the partners, and, you know, everything a consultant does.
What's left for what part does Intel play?
Well, obviously, Intel has a major role as the biggest promoter of WiMAX these days.
Right.
I think it's arguably their number one strategic initiative. They bring their name and their muscle. They bring their chips, ultimately.
Now, these are chips that are both used both on the client side and by you in your hardware?
Not today.
Not today.
Not today.
Okay.
But ultimately, you know, Intel doesn't have the chips yet commercially, but they're obviously still out there, you know, working the market and building up momentum for this, and this just plays part of it.
So the timing here is not that Intel has products, WiMAX products. It's the world's largest chip maker, and it sees a good opportunity for itself here if WiMAX spreads, but it's essentially pushing the project before it has a way to sell the stuff, has the stuff to sell, but presumably it's working on it at the same time that it's pushing the projects, I'd imagine.
Yes.
Okay.
And so this is just an opportunity for all of us to collaborate together and bring, you know, for example, we use what you might call pre-WiMAX or some of our proprietary product called Breeze Access BL, which is working in the unlicensed band, does OFDM, which is a technology that allows you to do some non-line of sight and some high capacities up to about, you know, 20 megs or so to a given user if you were to set it that high, and get everyone in that environment, get their feet wet, and then bring some broadband to fill the holes that they have out there in their county.
Okay, so was that essentially the instructions that Siemens brought to you? What was their charge to you? What did they say? Here, you're Alvarian. What do this for us? What did you do for them or for?
Well,
the
obviously, I mean, for us, they're a major. We're a major OEM for them.
Right.
They're a major partner and kind of globally for a lot of large carrier projects.
So you've worked with them a lot already.
A lot already, and they brought us in just specifically because of our expertise on the system side.
Okay.
And we've in the U.S. in these type of deployments, there's probably about 5,000 U.S. towns that have some degree of wireless broadband coverage using Alvarian systems.
Oh, okay. 5,000 towns?
Probably about 5,000.
Now, are those owned by the municipalities, by WISPs, by ISPs, by who's your client in these 5,000 towns?
That's one of the amazing things about this market. This is one of the sources of the hype of wireless, is that it's the great equalizer of broadband technologies. Virtually any operator type can deploy this thing, regardless of your availability of any kind of incumbent infrastructure. For example, you know, the telephone companies, they've got their twisted pair for their DSL.
Right.
The cable guys got their coax.
Right.
Some of the utilities have got fiber. Cellular guys have got towers and all this other sort of stuff.
Right.
But wireless is something that any of these and all of those can use, either to supplement their existing play, enter into competitive markets with very little regulatory overhead, and municipalities themselves can use it either to create T1 replacement sort of networks, or maybe even being catalysts, like in the case of Houston County, to bring broadband to the communities at large.
So did Houston, well, I want to talk about that, but I'm very intrigued by that as well. This means that, can you give us some kind of figure about what an entrepreneur or an entrepreneurial group that wanted to do this could would have to pay to get started? Are you allowed to say a dollar figure about that? Does that give away all the trade secrets?
I'd be allowed to say it, but the answer would be very different on many different levels. For
right.
example, a lot of it depends on what you already bring to the table. For example, about today in the U.S. or North America, I guess, because you have to include Canada, there's approximately 200 small local telephone companies that use our equipment.
Right.
Then there's probably 1,000 WISPs, wireless ISPs. Then there's probably over 80 utilities. And each one of these operators have different tolerances for payback. They have different access towards capital that they can leverage.
Right.
They're going to build in different ways.
Okay.
They all have different terrain. They all have different demographics, and that defines kind of what you do. But you can build, you know, using today's proprietary technologies from a company like Alvarian, in, say, the unlicensed band, you know, you can do a sector, let's say in a rural environment, 5-mile cell that would offer, let's see, each sector.
5-mile cell meaning a 5-mile radius?
5-mile radius that would, let's say, you're offering up to, you know, your average, each sector could maximum net throughput of roughly a little over 20 megabits, so 3 sectors. You could do 60 sectors at retail numbers of roughly under $20,000. You could build a cell like that, not counting labor, tower access, any of that sort of thing.
Right.
The hardware side.
Right.
And that's just kind of a retail number. You can do this very, very cost effectively in terms of homes passed.
Now, that means in a suburban or urban area, if what you've said is true about the, it doesn't have to be LOS anymore, you can cover an awful lot of homes for a very low cost, can't you?
That's correct. I mean, LOS obviously helps, and you're going to get more range with LOS.
Right.
But you can still, obviously, in a suburban or urban environment, your density's higher, so you don't need to have as big cells.
Right.
So.
And presumably, then, maybe if the cable companies, the phone companies, the ISPs, and the WISPs, and the municipalities, and a few startups bought into this, there could be some really drastic price wars, couldn't there?
There could, and again, it just depends on the tolerance of the person that's building it. You know, the WISPs tend to have a little bit less capital, so it's a little tougher for them to stretch out a return on investment that might go beyond 18 months or something. Whereas, for example, a publicly owned utility, and you have to understand that there are cooperatively owned utilities doing this, and then there are publicly owned. So even within the utility space, there's different types of operators.
Right.
Even between those two, they have different tolerances. A publicly owned utility, for example, might provide the service for as little as $25 a month for a low residential package.
Right.
Whereas your average WISP might be doing $39, $49, $69, depending on the tiers. They all try to find their niche. Some guys maybe just do commercial service. There's lots of options in there. But in any event, you can do this stuff very, very cost competitively. And that's for something that would deliver, 60 megabits of net capacity. There are systems that we have and others have that can provide less capacity for areas where the demographics are lighter, where it can be even less than that.
Right, because a lot of rural areas are both rural and sparsely populated.
Right. There are places that, you've seen a lot of this stuff has happened under the radar because there hasn't been a big U.S. operator that's really embraced this yet or since the debacle that Sprint and MCI tried with the very early generation equipment.
Right.
A lot of reasons why those things didn't fly. But what happened when everything else kind of went quiet is that the rural markets began to embrace these things because they had the big holes for their broadband, and they discovered that you could use these technologies very cost effectively in areas where you might even have just something like 7 homes per square mile.
Right.
So your cost per home passed using these technologies is extraordinarily low. And even in a WiMAX world where your base stations are going to be more expensive because these is real big, heavy iron carrier class stuff. Even then, maybe you're talking, $40,000, $50,000 for a full base station, but that's going to deliver maybe 80 megabits of net capacity, voice, data, maybe some video capability with anything that you would possibly need, full network management stations, and that's
right.
Pretty sophisticated technology.
Okay, let's get back to Houston County, Georgia. When did you set up what you set up, and what did you set up?
The trials, they were just tests, and they were temporary structures that were put up and put down in relatively short order. That all happened roughly about 2 months ago.
Okay.
And what Wireless Houston County, what Chairman Stone and his group decided to do was to take, instead of going to the easy places to test, sometimes people will test their wireless in a place like Phoenix where you can see your dog running away for 2 days and it's not much of a challenge.
Right.
What we decided to do to make the test meaningful was to find 5 difficult locations. So we found a residential home essentially buried in these big, beautiful Georgia woods. Chose a location that was the area of the police department, their headquarters, which, by the way, has no broadband.
I'm sorry, which department?
The police department.
Police department, right.
Which has no broadband, which is practically a travesty.
Right.
And then a couple other locations around the county that were very challenging. And so we erected temporary networks and were able to achieve, I think, in the worst case, something like better than a 6-megabit connection over like 13 miles across a very challenging terrain. So essentially what they were trying to demonstrate was to prove the technology to the folks that might be investors in the system ultimately and to the community at large.
Okay.
We know these technologies are certainly capable of doing that because we've been installing them for years. But to that environment, to that group of folks, it was new. So, they need to see it in action.
Now, I'm going to talk to Matt about this in more detail, but what was your view? Were you down there doing this with them?
I was down there for a part of it. In fact, I go back out there on the 12th for some additional meetings. But I was there for some of the final testing and for the public relations event that we had following the completion of the testing.
Right. What was that like? And in general, what was the reaction and interest of the local townsfolk?
Well, the interest is very large locally. It's actually the interest has come around. We've been getting inquiries much like yourself, kind of from around the world. And a lot of that is because of, you know, what Intel brings to bear when they decide to talk about something, essentially.
It was an Intel press release from South Africa that got me started on this. So.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. And as I told the folks there, Matt Stone, who wanted this to be recognized, he thought it was going to be the first project, and I had to let him know, well, actually, this has been done now for thousands of towns, but what's unique about yours is the first time that, the three leaders of the WiMAX value chain have gotten together to collaborate on a specific project.
Right.
Instead of just collaborating together to elevate the whole industry, we're working on a specific project here.
Right.
And that's a milestone in itself, and I think that's of great interest. The local community is very interested because, you know, there are lots of folks out there, both commercially and residentially, that don't have the access that, they need. And the best case of that is, for example, the police department. Those guys are still on dial-up. And it's very difficult to conduct you know, modern law enforcement when you have such a slow connection.
Right. Now, are you leaving? Did you leave the installations in place for them to use, or you took everything down at the end of the day?
They were just temporary. They were just temporary. Although I believe the equipment up on a couple of the towers on the infrastructure side is there.
Okay.
I believe it's still there.
And what was the final reaction in town to the study? This public relations. Event that you mentioned at the end. What happened there? Who said what about it? To whom?
Well, there was myself, a representative from Siemens, who was Greg Richardson, a representative from Intel, who's Paul Butcher, who's their director of the Digital Cities Initiative, and there was Chairman Stone. The room was pretty well populated with local press, both print, radio, and TV press. Some local officials.
And did the local press ask any questions? Were there any concerns or issues that were raised?
In fact, there was a couple very good questions. One of my favorites was that showed that there was an educated someone. There's people in there following it very closely because some folks had decided to get themselves educated. They were asking about, okay, is this really a WiMAX project or is this, you know, free WiMAX, and then they asked about LOS versus non-line of sight. So there were some intelligent questions that pleased me because it showed that the community had been paying attention.
Was there much discussion of the digital divide and how this can help eliminate it or reduce it?
Yeah, I think those comments came from Matt, and he can more specifically address that because he knows all the exact data from his environment.
Okay. Are there plans to go back and wireless them permanently now?
Oh, absolutely. And the intent of Houston County was never to do this on their own. Houston County doesn't want to be the carrier.
Right.
They want to be basically the instigator, and they've gone through all this effort and expense, and the vendors have as well, to help them put together a workable business plan. And then they go back, take this back to the community, and say, okay, who wants to join with us in promoting this thing? Because, you know, Houston is the public sector. They're not going to be providing the bandwidth themselves.
So are they planning on working with
a partnership with private industry to actually build this thing? And they're in the stages right now of getting investor support.
How about a co-op of all the people in Houston County to build it and own it and run it?
Who knows? Anything's possible.
Okay. Speaking of anything being possible, what can you tell us about how important a breakthrough this could be in less developed countries that don't even have power grids, and let alone DSL access, and what plans, if any, or what experience does Alvarion have in that area, or what plans does it have to put this into less developed countries as a way of bringing the internet and everything in it widely dispersed peoples?
Newsflash, Mark. The developing countries are far ahead of us in the U.S. in that regard.
Well, we like to have newsflashes here. What are they up to?
Well, they've been doing wireless for both voice and data for much longer than you found in the States, and to much greater extent. For example, we've got, wireless networks, wireless local loop with as many as over 200,000 lines in places like Brazil, Poland, elsewhere. We've got very extensive wireless networks and one that won an award in Namibia that connects hundreds and hundreds of schools out there in very, very rural, remote regions of the country.
So
we've got networks in the middle of the Belgian Congo doing voice and data.
It's the Congo now. They gave it back to the Africans. And
you know, there's okay. Well,
the former Belgian Congo.
Yeah, I'm just an ignorant U.S. guy.
That's okay.
But there's a lot of these sorts of networks. There's very, very large networks in most of the countries in Latin America. Virtually, I mean, we're deployed in about 130 different countries in very significant size networks. And, you know, in a lot of these regions, wireless is the first infrastructure. In some of the regions, it's so difficult to do copper simply because the population is so poor. If there's buried infrastructure, sometimes it'll get dug up, you know, for its scrap value.
Right.
So, you know, as I like to joke, wireless doesn't break. So it's a very natural technology to implement when there is no existing infrastructure. In fact, nothing can compete with it cost-wise in an environment where there's nothing there.
What about electricity? Does it sometimes go into areas that don't have electricity? And is the photovoltaic generation of electricity a nice companion technology to enable the client units to power themselves?
I'll give you one example. I don't know about the client units, but I'll give you a North American example.
Okay.
There's a community way up in the windswept southwestern corner of Newfoundland.
Right.
A little community called Bergio. And Bergio sits on the edge, literally, of the world almost. And it's got some neighboring community islands offshore. For example, one called Francois, one called Rania, with populations of just several hundred.
Right.
And some of those areas don't even have voice there. They
right.
have a couple community payphones that people use. So obviously their data access is, shall we say, a little bit limiting. So through a public-private partnership of a group called Bergio Broadcasting System, a little bit of funding from the province up there, the Canadian government from the federal side, and a bunch of other different groups. They brought broadband in from the mainland using our equipment, going 120 kilometers island hopping, and the cells, many of them, are powered with wind and solar on top of these very, very windswept, isolated mountains.
And how is internet access then distributed on the islands?
Well, first, it primarily was first to connect the schools
right.
and the hospitals. So what they do is they do telemedicine sessions in the morning, and then they do distance learning in the afternoons using the broadband. So
right.
now the kids are connected to their peers on the mainland. With the intent is to make the community vibrant enough so they can stop the attrition of the population.
Right.
Because the declining fisheries has resulted in some cases 31% decline in the population of these, you know, towns. But guess what? People are born there, they work there, they pray there, they die there. And to keep these communities vital, they've got to have the broadband.
Well, of course, small picturesque islands off Atlantic Canada aren't the only places where a lot of people leave their villages and go to the city. In vast swaths of Africa and other places, that happens a lot, leaving the villages with only old people, essentially.
And thus, you kind of, the whole picture begins to gel for why, you know, although I hate the word ubiquitous, it applies.
That's okay.
Why ubiquitous broadband is so important. It's really important for its quality of life issue at the heart of the thing.
Right. Now, I interviewed a vice president at a company called Sky Tower yesterday in Monrovia. They build solar-powered stratospheric platforms that they're hoping to hook up voice and broadband internet transponders to and cover vast areas at very low cost. Are you specifically working with them, and or more generally, have you gotten involved with any of these plans to put your equipment up into the stratosphere?
Don't know. It's been there already on some temporary deployments,
right.
Swedish aerospace balloon. But you know, nothing is off the table. And when you understand that the concepts are limitless, but you've got to focus your energies. And right now, we're very, very focused on WiMAX, because you know that's really what's required to create mass, so all these markets, local and domestic, international, can benefit from the mass that interoperability breeds, so we can get these very inexpensive client-side devices so you can make the business model work even for residential, in whether it's urban, suburban, or rural.
Who can we expect will be making these interoperable 802.16-204 compliant boxes?
over time, you know, I think the same people that you would see doing major consumer electronics over time. I mean, you probably see the, you know, the Samsungs of the world, those kind of people.
Right.
I'm sure. Whoever you see making commodity products today.
Okay. What's the timetable from now until whenever to in the WiMAX process? Who has to do what next?
Well, they're finishing up the profiles, which is the kind of what the rule's going to be technically.
Right.
Given they're specific to various frequency bands. The first one they're choosing is 3.5 gigahertz. Not available in the U.S. Why are they doing it? Well, because it's the most accepted band in use today for wireless broadband internationally. So that's where you can create mass first.
Right.
And kind of get a jump start.
Where is it the standard? Is it used?
Where's 3.5 used?
Right.
Virtually everywhere but here.
How'd that happen?
Well, because Donald Rumsfeld owns it here, and we're not going to take anything away from him now.
Okay, got it.
So, no, but seriously, the DoD owns 3.5 in the U.S., although the FCC is in the process now of trying to open up a few megahertz at 3650 to 3700.
Okay.
So the FCC has been pretty progressive of late trying to make spectrum available because they're very excited about this because a lot of this stuff has been happening over the past years without any public funding. You know, people have just decided to do it, and government's always happy when the private sector jumps in to fill a problem. And so now they're looking, they figure, okay, with just a little bit of a push, we can really help make this thing explode in the U.S. to the degree it has already done elsewhere. So the FCC is involved trying to get broadcasters to vacate some of the analog TV bands, go digital, then those bands will be available for wireless broadband. They've opened up new spectrum in 5 gigahertz for both wireless LAN and for wireless broadband. So they're trying to do a lot, and Chairman Powell is a very big advocate of this stuff. I've met him a couple times, toured him with a customer with a WISP site, and you know, he was very well informed, as was his staff.
Okay, so is there some timetable or deadline that you think the interoperable standard will be released?
Well, it's the standard from the IEEE standpoint is released. It's being finished by the WiMAX forum, and I think you'll see the first bits of interoperability testing, what they're calling PlugFest, as early as late this year, and certainly by the very beginning of this coming year.
So it won't exactly be ready for Christmas gifts, but soon thereafter.
Not quite, but my guess is you could place the orders by Christmas.
Right.
You know, we're taking orders already for our BreezeMax system, certainly.
Okay, you give gift certificates.
That's right.
For that.
We're happy to do rain checks, but the CPE side, I think Intel has said, and you probably want to get hold of them for the latest, but that the chips should be available commercially in commercial quantities sometime mid-2005.
These are the chips that are going to be the core of these client-side pieces?
The core of the client-side piece, that's correct.
Okay. One last question that I didn't know anything about, but I'm looking at your Google search, and everybody's talking about how you paid $56 million for a company called Mobility. What's up with that?
Interwave?
Yes.
Well, I'd refer you to, I guess, the public comments, I guess, by our CEO today on our public conference call, which is archived at our
okay. The
main website at alvarian.com.
I'll put a link to that.
But in general, they do cellular, and what that brings to the table for us is as WiMAX moves and advances towards the end game of portable and mobility,
right.
It gives us some in-house, some very good in-house expertise on the mobile side because it's very complex from you know, how you handle all the roaming and the billing and all that sort of thing.
Right.
So it gives us a lot of in-house expertise on that. Also, their current systems play very, very well in the rural environment. They have what they call a network in a box for basically 3G systems, and it's an excellent sort of product for a rural market where they're trying to bring in, for a small set of demographics, a local cellular system
right.
without having to have the call routed through, you know, Johannesburg or something.
Right.
There's a network in a box, has a switch right in there, so all the calls terminate at that one point. So you can use it on a cruise ship or, you know, any place where the demographics don't support a full cellular network. And those are markets we obviously understand very well because we've been so strong in these rural markets internationally for so many years now.
So there's a lot of technical and marketing synergy. with them.
Yeah, it was, it's a very good acquisition for us and we think for them.
What do you see as the sort of, I can't say ultimate because this is constantly evolving, but in 5 years, will people have one device that's a cell phone and an internet connection, or will they have their some kind of laptop for watching video and a cell phone that's almost an implant by then for conversation?
I get asked this a lot. In Toronto recently. Look at it this way. In terms of how you connect to the world via voice,
right.
Chances are you've got a cell phone on your hip or somewhere within arm's reach.
Right.
But currently you're talking on a landline. When you go home, you still probably have a landline.
Right.
What I think most people don't realize and the analysts don't yet account for is I think ultimately over time people will have multiple broadband connections that will serve probably different needs. They may have a way of intercommunicating, but I think they may have several distinct connections. Currently, if you look at all the data about broadband, they look at everything like everything is competing with the other. I think a lot of these things will live side by side, certainly in the short and near term. That includes 3G and WiMAX systems. My expectation is that they will live side by side for the near term, maybe ultimately converging, you know, way down the road, 2009, 2010, who knows.
Meaning I'd have a cell phone to talk, and I'd have a laptop to compute, and I'd have a big screen to watch big screen things,
yes.
and they could all be hooked up to different wireless networks depending on the particular needs for those particular applications.
Sure, and they may all communicate on some level, and maybe when they're within range, who knows? Maybe it's ultra wideband, maybe it's some derivative of Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, who knows?
But right.
Maybe all these technologies are integrated so the devices communicate, but in a sociological way, you fundamentally use devices differently. I think you will
right.
always use your cell phone fundamentally different than you will use something like a laptop. It's as much about form factor and usability as anything else. It's got nothing necessarily to do with the computing power.
Right.
There's a sociological angle, so I think you'll see people using, you know, multiple devices and multiple forms of access.
All right, and one of them will be broadband wireless, and I want to thank you very much for talking to us and explaining most of the complicated and a lot of the important issues here about broadband wireless access, and I want to wish you and Alvarion good luck in spreading more bits.
Thanks, Mark. We really appreciate it, and hello to all the folks at Etopia.
Okay, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Talk to you later.